Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory today and for future generations. Join Kel Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Changes.
We are justified in doing anything we can to survive.
And good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your fellow hosts, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. We hope that you're enjoying your Monday afternoon, and we're glad that you are filing in and joining us. Today we're going to talk about something very interesting, and we hope that you find it interesting as well. This is going to be the counter-jihadist 18-point plan, and with that, I'm going to carry it right over to the fellow host, Tim Burton. And Tim, hi, how are you doing today?
Hello there, Kel. I'm good. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Things are just rolling along quite nicely.
Yes, indeed. And now that you mentioned the 18-point plan, I suppose what I ought to do is expand on it and say exactly whose 18-point plan it is. It was drawn up and posted a couple of months ago under the Jihad. It was posted on the Jihad Watch website and also Pamela Geller's website, and it was drawn up by the American Freedom Defense Initiative in conjunction with SION, which is Stop the Islamization of Nations. And what it is a plan which, if it were implemented by a government that actually cared more about the rights and freedoms of the indigenous people in their country, as opposed to what we have now, which is governments who predominantly put the rights and freedoms of anybody else but the indigenous people that they are supposed to be looking after, they put those first. Then if these 18 points were implemented, they would go a long way towards containing and controlling the Islamic encroachment in our societies. Now, I use the words containment and controlling because there's various ways you could approach this particular situation we find ourselves in at the moment. There are people who would like nothing better than to just have every last Muslim shipped out of the country, and while that might be logistically possible, it's a somewhat drastic measure at this stage, and there are other things that could be done to make a transition more smooth and with less blood on the streets, shall we say? Because at the end of the day, any government can come in and say, right, this is the way we're going to do it. And I'm thinking, as an example, what the Czechoslovak government did at the end of World War II. They said, right, we don't want any Germans living in our country at all. We've just defeated the Nazis and the Third Reich. Uh-huh. And we really don't want what was then about 3 million Germans in their country. They just said, right, we're just going to ship you out wholesale back to Germany, and that is what they did. Now, it wasn't a bloodless thing by any means. There were several tens of thousands of Germans who died during that particular operation. I only mention it from the point of view of saying what is logistically possible. Now, quite honestly, although I don't like where we are at the moment with the encroaching Islamization of our countries, that doesn't mean that I would necessarily want to take that way out, because it would mean blood on the streets, and that's not necessarily the way forward. We have time before the Islamic demographics overwhelm us. And during that time, if we had, as I said, a government that put the rights and freedoms of the indigenous peoples first and foremost, if we put these 18 points into effect, we'd go a long way to turning back the tide. So that's the 18-point plan I'm talking about. And the 18-point plan, I think you've got in your show notes on the on the front of your webpage. Let me just scroll down and check. Why can't I see them? I'm sure I should be able to. Never mind. Okay, I can't see. For some reason, I can't see them on the screen I'm looking at. But
here, I don't know if you're in the if you're not in the chat room, you won't be able to see it there. But I'm going to post the link right in the chat room right now.
Okay, that's good, because I can't actually see the chat room where I am for some reason. I know I'm logged into Skype. I know I'm in your view because we're talking, but I can't see the chat room, and I'm not sure why that is. But nevertheless, if you're going to post that that link, then that's fine, and we can talk about each individual point there if you like. I think it's important that we talk about the individual points, because I frequently refer to this particular 18-point plan. Well, I'm not the only one, but people who talk shows like this about the approach that should be taken to counter jihad frequently refer to this 18-point plan. And a lot of people may think, oh, yeah, okay, there's that 18-point plan being mentioned again. I wonder what it is. So I thought it would be good if we could briefly go through each point one by one, highlight it, and then if we need to, we can expand, spend a couple of minutes on each point expanding.
Absolutely.
It and answering any questions that each of us might have for the other. So that's the background of that.
What I did is that I did post that link from Atlas Shrugs, and that is American Freedom Defense Initiative announces platform for defending freedom in wake of Boston Jihad.
Yep, okay.
And the first point that they bring up, the AFDI, denounces the crippling rules of engagement under which our soldiers are forced to labor. They should be given the freedom to defend themselves and protect their comrades.
Yes, indeed. Now, that particular point is not necessarily on its own going to affect us back in our homelands,
yeah.
But it is one of the things which ought to be done in conjunction with all the others. I mean, I'm with U.S. soldiers in particular. This was written by a U.S. citizen, and I think it refers in particular to U.S. soldiers, where the rules of engagement have effectively turned U.S. soldiers into social workers rather than people who are there to win a war. What that means is certainly from the point of view of American troops is that they are just cannon fodder for Afghani or any sort of Middle East insurgency that wants to use them as target practice. And if they were allowed to operate as they have been trained to do in order to win the war which they are ostensibly over there to fight, it would be better. At the moment, they are restricted quite substantially. I assume that soldiers, not necessarily U.S. soldiers, but soldiers from other Western countries who are fighting over in Afghanistan in particular, or Iraq and Afghanistan, I imagine that they are going to be under similar restrictions, if not the same. I don't know if you can elaborate on that, but that's really the...
Oh, I could elaborate on that for like the entire hour, just the one point there. And I wholeheartedly agree with that, is that I have always said that we have turned our soldiers into social workers, and we're not winning the hearts and minds of these people in the Middle East and Asian areas people. We have to allow our soldiers to be soldiers, and that is to defend our shores. They're over there to prevent another 9/11. We have seen the ramifications of terrorism, i.e. 9/11. England has seen it via 7/7. Spain has seen it. Canada has dodged the bullet so far, but I'm just giving it a matter of time. But
mm-hmm.
What I'm very tired of, Tim, is our soldiers go over there on a mission, and they end up sitting around and they're negotiating and they're making nice and they're passing out candies to the local children who are, what in my opinion, are future jihadists.
Mm-hmm.
They are mentoring the native troops in Afghanistan, for in particular the ANA. All we are seeing is green off blue violence. We're not winning their hearts and minds. So I think it's time to take the gloves off, forget this nonsense, and just get the job done.
Yes, I agree. I agree entirely with that, and I think it's a huge, huge mistake to leave soldiers, not just U.S. soldiers, although they are bearing the brunt of it, but soldiers from other Western countries trying to fight a war where effectively they have given away, or the administrations of the various Western countries have given away so much to the enemy in terms of concessions. First and foremost, shall we say, they have said any future government in Afghanistan will be Sharia compliant. Now, that to me seems to be such an obstacle that once you have said that you're going to allow them to have a Sharia compliant government, you may just as well pack up and go home, because everything else that follows from that is going to work against you in every conceivable way. And there's no way you can fight a war if you are promoting a government whose ideals, if they're based on Sharia, are going to be implacably opposed to you. So for that reason alone, I would counsel the removal of soldiers. If they're not going to be allowed to fight the war in the way that it should be fought, if we ever decided we wanted to win it, then they should be brought back home. But,
and it's frustrating that this is not the mechanical wars that we're used to fighting. This is not World War II. This is not even Korea, for goodness sake. This is a hearts and minds soul-seeking mission in my eyes. Our soldiers' hands have been tied to the point where, they cannot do anything. And even in the United States in particular, they're not even safe on their own bases. And I would go one step further with this particular point and ban Muslims from joining the military altogether.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's that really is the next step. Although I don't think it's actually mentioned in this particular
something that I threw in there. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, there's a good case for actually ruling out people from joining not only the military but also any involvement in local police forces, any involvement in the criminal justice system, politics at national and local level, purely because their first loyalty is not to the country of which they may be citizens. Their first loyalty is to the Ummah. And when you're fighting a war where the Ummah is implacably opposed to Western countries, it doesn't make sense to have people in those categories who effectively serve as a fifth column. But yes, you're absolutely right on that. Do you want to move on to the next point on that
I agree entirely
with you that we could talk about just that one point for the hour, because loads of things have just popped up in my head. But nevertheless, we did say we're going to work through this list. So,
And plus, too, we don't want to rush through everything. We will take our time, but I'm also very excited to announce to the listeners that Jan Rennie of the Christian Defense League will be joining us after the top of the hour. So we also want to give her her platform as well. But these are really important points, people. And the second one, Tim, AFDI calls for profiling of Muslims at airports and in hiring in professions in which national security and public safety could be compromised.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, that does touch upon what I was talking about just now, where I was looking further down the list and I couldn't see what I wanted to talk about. But areas such as the military that you mentioned, police forces, the criminal justice system, anywhere in the criminal justice system, especially with the perverse judgments that we have seen that certainly in the UK where I live, where judgments are frequently very lenient on Muslims and correspondingly much harsher on non-Muslims, not necessarily because it's Muslims themselves that are making those decisions, but certainly if you've got Muslims involved in the criminal justice system, it doesn't help the cause of justice because their primary loyalty, as I said, is to the Ummah and not to the justice system, which at the end of the day is a man-made justice system devised predominantly by the Kuffar. And the Muslims, of course, consider they have a vastly superior justice system. And therefore, if you have them in our justice system, you can't really expect them to operate in our best interests. So there's that. There's also the question of local and national politics. I was just getting to that,
yes, especially higher echelons of office and politics.
Well, yeah, I mean, in particular in the U.S., it's well known that the United States Obama administration is absolutely riddled with Muslim Brotherhood sympathisers, so
yes,
they've got a huge problem there. We have a similar thing, but not quite to such a great extent over here. We have local councils are frequently populated with Muslim majorities, which means that the decisions that are taken in areas when it concerns the building of mosques or other things which might give preference to the Muslim population, they are frequently pushed through, and things which might not be in the best interest of the Muslim population, they are frequently denounced and rejected. And if you wouldn't get this, if you had non-Muslims running a local council or anywhere in local and national politics, they are by and large unlikely to make decisions which favour one religious group over another. I'm not saying it's invariable. I'm not saying that every councillor or politician would be completely unbiased, but there wouldn't be the naked bias that you get when you have Muslims in these positions of authority in local and national politics. I'm sure you could list 100 examples in Canada. I could certainly list 100 examples over here, but as a point of principle, national and local councillors, politicians should be vetted, and if they've got any kind of allegiance to...
Absolutely. And that's how they build their bona fides, that they start out at the grassroots or the local levels, rather, I suppose, and that they join the school boards, or they run for a city councillor, or
yes,
they run for mayor. And in Canada in particular, we have a mayor, his name is Nenshi, and he is the mayor of Calgary, and he's very close friends with Pierre Elliott Trudeau's golden pony son, and that's Justin Trudeau. And Justin Trudeau is the federal leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. So if Justin Trudeau ever comes to office, which may be a dire possibility,
this guy
could have a cabinet seat somewhere in his caucus. It worries me.
Yeah, well, and so it should, because is he going to take completely unbiased decisions and completely ignore the fact that he himself is a Muslim? I think that's highly unlikely, given the...
No, he's inviting all the Muslims from Quebec to move to Calgary because of the Quebec Values Charter that they're undergoing, and that's the no overt display of religious garb, as it were. And so Nenshi, he went on record saying to all the Muslims in Quebec, come on over to Calgary. We have plenty of room for you.
Mm. Yeah.
So,
The other item in that second point is to do with implementing profiling of Muslims at airports. Now, I am similar in Canada and the United States, but we're in the unenviable position here that Muslims are employed at various places at our airports, including airside, which is to say that they have been supposedly vetted and given the higher security clearance in order to work airside, and yet we frequently get cases where Muslims have been found to have been abusing their positions as airport workers. And that's obviously very sensitive, given the number of terrorist plots that have been thwarted in and around UK airports. So there's that side of it. And then, of course, you've got passengers who are going to board these planes, even if they don't need the appropriate security clearance. If you have a group of Muslims travelling on a particular flight, there are rules in place to stop overzealous airport screeners from pulling out more than one or two Muslims in a queue of maybe 20 or 30 Muslims in case they are deemed to be racist and Islamophobic. Never mind the fact that these guys might look suspicious, or they might be exhibiting suspicious behaviour. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, trying to board an aircraft with a bomb in the hand, but there are things that you look for as a trained airport screener in passengers' behaviour. But if these people are Middle Eastern appearance, you cannot pull them out disproportionately from you have to treat the 76-year-old white granny in a wheelchair, for example, you have to treat her in exactly the same way, which is absolutely crazy. Profiling should be reintroduced, and certainly workers in airports should be strictly vetted, and any Muslim bias that's detected, by which I mean if they happen to be Muslim or if they happen to have a Muslim background, that should be a case for certainly reviewing or revoking their security clearance. So, I mean, it's common sense, really, but at the moment we don't do it, and I'm sure
no,
that's
we don't.
The case, and I imagine it's the case in Canada.
I find it very frustrating in that the 98-year-old grandmother in the wheelchair is being groped by the TSA in the United States in particular.
Oh, yes.
They're quite ruthless down there, the TSA. There is something that I have always suggested, and of course nobody will ever listen to me, and that is system analysis, and that is profiling. We have to understand what exactly the threat of terrorism is, where it comes from, who the perpetrators are, and concentrate on that, and pardon me, and political correctness be damned. This is our society. This is our lives that are being threatened. We are in a position, we are so fragile, and we are just going to make ourselves that much more vulnerable in not paying attention to the actual threat. So I think that systems analysis is the way to go. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, take a swarthy male with a full beard between the ages of 18 and 35 and target that. Don't be picking on six-year-old kids who have a broken leg, and you're probing around in their cast to make sure they don't have some sort of incendiary device or an explosive in their cast. I mean, for goodness sake, let's be real about the threat. Let's be real about the threat.
Yes, I mean, at the end of the day, the best screeners in the world won't necessarily catch 100% of the potential threats that are out there, but you have to work on what is most likely. And certainly profiling at airports is one of the things that really must be done, because, like you say, it's lives that are at threat. Every time we travel on an aeroplane, we are putting our lives in the hands of people. We have to trust that they know what they're doing. At the moment, I certainly wouldn't trust anybody in any authority that looks after the hiring of workers at airports. I wouldn't trust them with my life, and I wouldn't really at this point want to fly unless I really had to.
That's right.
Okay, do you want to move on to the
next point? And actually point three and point four kind of tie in together, so I'm just going to recite them. AFDI calls for immediate investigation into foreign mosque funding in the West and for new legislation making foreign funding of mosque in non-Muslim nations illegal. And this ties into point four, which is AFDI calls for surveillance of mosques and regular inspections of mosques in the U.S. and other non-Muslim nations to look for pro-violence material. Any mosque advocating jihad or any aspect aspects of Sharia that conflict with constitutional freedoms and protections should be closed?
Yes, and in fact, I'd go further than that. I would say any mosque advocating jihad or aspects of Sharia that conflict with constitutional freedoms and protections should not only be closed, but bulldozed to the ground and the land given over to non-Muslims for worthy purposes such as pig racing on Fridays.
But, see, this is why you and I get along so well, Tim. We read each other's minds.
That's just my opinion. But yeah, I mean, what the important thing here is that mosques are not just places of worship. They are forward command and control centers, and they are primarily so that Muslims can establish a beachhead in a particular area, and from there they can spread out and do whatever they need to do to advance Islam in their local area. And if Islam were, as Muslims sometimes claim, a benign, tolerant and peaceful religion, that wouldn't matter so much. But the problem is that it's nothing of the sort. It's neither benign, tolerant nor peaceful. And in fact, if you look at description of a religion compared to the description or definition of a cult or a political ideology, it's closer to a cult and a political ideology than it is to a religion. So for that reason alone, we should be taking a very close look at what is allowed in mosques, if we're not going to just bulldoze mosques wholesale and say there will be no practice of Islam in the public space and get rid of mosques altogether. But let's take this a step at a time and say if we're going to have mosques, first of all, let's look very closely about whether we're going to allow any more to be built for a start. Secondly, the ones that we've got, we've got to keep a very, very close eye on. And if there's any hint of any treasonous or seditious behavior that's being taught or practiced in those mosques, then we should take care of that. And that, I suppose, really sums it up.
Well, I think, I mean, the whole premise of this 18-point plan, too, is to see Islam recognized as a political entity as opposed to a religious entity, because we know it's 80% political anyway. I mean, there's a smattering of religiosity within it. However, that religiosity falls under the realm of Sharia law, and everybody who listens to any of these counter-jihadist radio programs is fully aware of what Sharia law is and what it entails. So I would love to see happen is that, Tim, that we do stop any further construction of mosques in the West, because they are nothing but hotbeds for jihad, kinetic jihad, the lower jihad, and that they do proselytize violence against non-Muslims.
Indeed they do, and no matter how much they tell you to the contrary. As I'm often fond of saying, to paraphrase Confucius, when in hole, stop digging. And we obviously have a problem with with mosques. Therefore, why add to that problem by allowing the building of any new mosques or the conversion of any existing buildings to for mosque purposes? Why do it? In today's Western societies, there's absolutely no good reason, if you're going to put the well-being of the indigenous relations first and foremost, which is what it comes back to, there is absolutely no good reason to allow further mosque construction and every good reason to look very closely at what we have and decide whether or not it's going to be allowed to stay open. So, and funding, of course, that's another question altogether. We know there's a lot of money coming from oil revenues that are finding their way into the West to build these mosques and propagate the most violent forms of Islam, such as Salafism and Wahhabism. So, yes, we ought to make foreign funding of mosques illegal. And really, I don't know that I really need to elaborate too much more on those particular two points.
No. And because I think everybody would be in agreement with what you're saying, what I'm saying, what we're sharing, in that there is a real threat behind the mosque situation in particular. Really disconcerts me, because there is an issue with the mosque. And, of course, this article by Atlas Shrugs was inspired by the Boston bombings.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what happened. The those two brothers, they were inspired in their mosques. That one mosque in particular was actually funded. They were found to be funding. They were found to be fraudulently funded, and the mosque was under surveillance after that. But that did not slow down these two brothers in committing the atrocities that they did in Boston that day.
No, no,
but
indeed.
Yeah.
And we've got similar circumstances surrounding a lot of the Islamic atrocities in the West. I'm thinking about 7/7 in the United Kingdom, where at least one, if not more, of the bombers was radicalized, apparently, in a UK mosque. What happened about that mosque? Did it get closed down? Did it come under any more intense scrutiny? Not that I know of. I believe it's still operating, it's still
up and running. Yeah.
Mm.
And this ties into the next point of the 18-point counter-jihad plan, and that is AFDI calls for curriculum and Islam-related materials in textbooks and museums to describe Islamic doctrine and history accurately, including its violent doctrine and 1,400-year war against unbelievers.
Yes, well, that's a huge problem everywhere in the West, insofar as Muslims in positions of authority in education authorities and anything to do with educating our young children are pushing for texts which whitewash Islam to extraordinary degrees. I think we've spoke about this last week about the education system and how it's geared towards not offending Muslims and how textbooks that promote Islam, as a matter of fact, Tim, you and myself,
we were discussing that textbook in Florida in particular.
We were indeed. So, I mean, that's a very relevant point. And, of course, this textbook called
World History, and they devoted 34 pages to Islam and no other religion. So, well, you know, religions. You and I both know what Islam is not, but no other quote-unquote religion was mentioned in the World History textbook, and that's why the parents in Florida were complaining about that.
Yes, indeed. And even when it's not as blatant as that, we get situations where, as you know, from only last week that was being discussed on various counter-jihad sites, where schools, even at primary school level, are inflicting Islamic various aspects of Islam on very young, impressionable children and exposing them to, again, a whitewashed version of Islam and taking them to see Islamic workshops like the one in Staffordshire the other week that we discussed. And that's being done under the threat of issuing racial discrimination notes to young children if they refuse or if their parents refuse to submit to that sort of indoctrination. So it's very, very pervasive, and we need to be taking a long, hard look at that. And certainly if we get a degree of sanity returning to our political system, one of the very first things we should do is to look at what is being taught at every level in education, in schools, colleges, any places of learning, in fact, throughout the West. We have to take a very close look at that.
The thing is that this point and what happened in the UK, what happened over there in England is, the cheat sheet being added into the pupils' file, and that they would be considered being racist if they did not attend this Discover Islam workshop, as it were, at this university.
Yeah.
That sort of thing is very disturbing.
Yeah.
Tim. Very. And it bothers me in that, when they infuse Islam in the curriculum, and they do not talk about the entire history of Islam, I think that's a problem, because as we know, and I just mentioned this a few minutes ago, about 80% of the Quran, if not more, is nothing about violent kinetic jihad, the lesser jihad. And they do not teach that in our public schools. As a matter of fact, what they're doing is that they're forcing our children to embrace Islam as a religion of peace. Well, it's not a religion of peace, people. We know that. We're witnessing that. One thing that bothers me too, Tim, is that when we see all of the kinetic jihad going on and the Muslims in their so-called communities are not taking responsibility for it, and that's why I have lost my... I used to say that there was such a thing as a moderate Muslim, but I do not believe that any longer. I believe that a Muslim is a Muslim. I did a segment, as you know, on what happens when jihad comes to town, where will you stand? And we have seen case after case in history where the Muslims, well, once the numbers grow, they stand with the jihad.
Yes, indeed. And that's something that we're going to have to ask again, in the not-too-distant future, if we don't want civil war on our streets, because we only have to look at what's happening in Syria at the moment, where formerly Christians and Muslims lived side by side, and you would think that having lived side by side, in some cases for generations, as neighbours, if the jihad came to town, that Muslims would perhaps put their sense of community and their long-standing friendships with their neighbours first and foremost. In fact, what we have seen is they do just the reverse. They take the side of the Ummah, and if they are told that it's their devout duty to slaughter the neighbours that they have lived with side by side, in some cases for generations, that's what they'll do. And
exactly.
There's no reason to believe that Muslims over here will be any different from Muslims over there, because they are brought up in the same way, brainwashed with the Islamic ideology by the Quran. It's the same Quran over there as it is over here. We don't have any reason to believe they'll do any different. So, yes, that's a very important point.
This one,
and
I
suppose
really
that
like.
Leads to... Mm-hmm. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to move on to the next point, and it kind of does tie in, and I like this because what it does is that this point in particular, it will tie back into the mosque funding and everything. Mm-hmm. This one I like. AFDI calls for a halt to foreign aid to Islamic nations with Sharia-based constitutions and or governments. That one I like a lot.
Well, yes, and the reason I suppose that people are so, or governments at the moment are so keen to give foreign aid to these Islamic nations, is from a misplaced sense of altruism. They see that we, as Western nations, are generally a lot more prosperous, a lot more civilized than Islamic nations, and people in Islamic nations, a lot of them live in poverty. And you can hardly hold up any Islamic country as a model of civilization anywhere in the world. But if you were to halt foreign aid to these nations, yes, I'm sure there would be a certain amount of wailing and gnashing of teeth, and there might well be some short-term pain in these nations that were relying on Western money in order to prop up the Sharia-based constitutions or Sharia-based governments. But once you take away that foreign aid and people can see that the Sharia-based constitutions and Sharia-based governments are absolutely useless on their own in providing any kind of model for civilization, they've got two choices. They can either go back to living in 7th century conditions and stay there, or they can say, okay, we'll change the way we do things, we'll embrace democracy and the rule of law as we know it, and maybe at that point there would be a case of a controlled flow of money in order to rebuild previously Sharia-based constitutions and governments in the Western mold. Now, I'm not saying that that's a perfect way of doing it, and in fact, I'm sure when George Bush overthrew Saddam not too long ago and had the idea that he was going to impose democracy in Iraq,
which I always thought was a big mistake.
Well, you have to realize that people that are brought up with the Sharia first and foremost, ever since their childhood, they don't believe that democracy is a superior model. Well, fine.
No.
You live with Sharia then, and you use that model, but don't come and bother us. Don't come asking us for money. Don't try and emigrate to our countries. Stay right where you are and live out the rest of your life and your children's lives and the grandchildren's lives in complete poverty and misery, if that is what you prefer. It's not a very altruistic way of doing things, and it goes against the grain for a lot of these liberal do-gooders who feel that we should be treating everybody equally. But the fact is, unless they have got the appropriate mindset to accept a civilized model as we understand it, why should we, if they are given money and they are going to be actively hostile towards us, why should we give them money? If they want to do their own way of doing things with an ideology that was not actively alien and hostile towards us, not actively hostile towards us, that would be one thing. So, say for example, if tomorrow we were to discover, I don't know, a tribe in the Amazon, and we came along and we explained how we did things to them, and they'd been doing it a certain way for thousands of years, and they said, well, you know, we really could do with a little bit of money to help develop our own civilization. We don't particularly want to follow the democratic way, but we promise not to interfere with the way you do things. Well, okay, you might then give some money in order for them to develop, give them humanitarian advantages, maybe build hospitals, roads, schools, and so on. You might help them in those ways if their ideology was not implacably opposed to yours. But as far as Middle Eastern countries are concerned, if they have the Sharia law to guide their forms of government or their constitution, why give them money? Why not just let them fail?
Exactly.
Let them fail, and then when they're completely in a complete mess because they have chosen Sharia law, then, you know, it might take 100 years, might take 1,000 years. But, you know, why give them money in the meantime if they are only going to turn it around and use it
for
purpose?
And one thing, Tim, that I will never understand, and this flabbergasts me, is that the Western nations, some Western nations, have allowed the installation of Sharia-based family courts. And I know England has a real issue with the Sharia-based family courts. It all started out quite innocently that, hey, let us take some of the case files off your hands, British courts, and let us deal with the minor cases, family disputes. And it was promised that they would follow the canon laws, and, oh, no problem, bro. Yeah, we'll do that. We have found out in short time that, no, they're not.
Yep, no, they're not. Well, there's an Arab saying, and I don't know what it is in Arabic. I don't speak Arabic in particular. But the Arabic saying is, you've got to be very careful about letting the nose of the camel into the tent.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you do, the rest of the camel is not far behind. And that's what we're seeing with Sharia law. It's one thing to say, okay, if Muslims want to settle a civil dispute between themselves and they want to use Sharia law and not bother with the Western laws, that's fine as long as it doesn't run contrary to Western law. But of course, so much of Sharia law does run contrary to Western law, and in particular, even in civil disputes. Inheritance, for example, a woman can only inherit half of what a man can inherit. That is unjust according to our laws and shouldn't be permitted.
And
in
Western societies, that sort of thing is blatantly practiced underneath our noses. And, the camel's nose did get in the tent. And going to be able to push it out, especially when it does come to the Sharia?
Well, yeah, the only logical course of action is to say, no, you will not use this. And make it quite clear to everybody involved that if they have been subject to a Sharia law decision that they don't like, that British law or Western law takes precedent, and we even say if we find that Sharia law has been the basis of any decision that's made that's to the disadvantage of a woman in those kind of conditions, then penalties will be applied, and that would make imams think twice before using Sharia law that's going to disadvantage one section of society, such as women, in the case of inheritance law or in the case of divorce. And of course, when you're looking at Sharia law for criminal law, then it runs counter in many ways to Western laws. So it goes without saying that Sharia law should just be forbidden full stop, and penalties should be applied to any imam that's caught implementing it if it's to the disadvantage of one of the parties. Well, I say if it's to the disadvantage of a party compared to what it would be if it was in Western law.
And you know what? That's kind of we covered point 6 and point 7, and point 7 being AFDI denounces the use of Sharia law in any Western court or nation. And point 8 here is AFDI advocates deportation hearings against non-citizens who promote jihad in our nations.
Well, this ties into what we were talking about with mosques. If we're going to allow mosques at all, then they should be registered, licensed, monitored very strictly. And if anybody in a mosque promotes jihad or anything that is of a seditious or treasonous nature, and of course a lot of Islamic teachings straight out of the Quran fall into just that category. Well, that's a little problem the Muslims are going to have to sort out themselves. But anybody who's found promoting jihad should be treated very, very harshly. We are at a point where we cannot afford to be tolerant in this aspect. If Muslims were only one half of 1% of our country, and they did not follow an ideology which is alien and hostile to the provisions that our civilization provides for its citizens, that would be one thing. But they are now becoming a substantial proportion of the population and due to get a lot bigger. So, again, if they are found to be behaving in that way, we should certainly be saying implement deportation hearings against non-citizens. And we're talking about jihad, people who promote jihad, any form of Islamic supremacism or intolerance towards the rest of us, or anti-Semitism towards Jews, or any sort of anti-Muslim ideas that might inspire Muslims to feel that we are somehow of less worth than Muslims themselves. Anything like that should be treated extremely severely. Of course, I am aware when I say this that this would effectively destroy Islam altogether if that were actually taken to heart and were preached in mosques in that form. If imams had to say, well, we can't actually this week in our Friday sermon, we can't actually teach anything that promotes jihad, we can't teach anti-Semitism, we can't teach anti-Christian teachings, you may as well all go home and have the afternoon off.
Exactly. Now, I want to move on to point 9, because this one is how shall I put it? It's one that we can really sink our teeth into, and this is going to be very much a point of dissension for a lot of people of the Muslim persuasion. AFDI calls for an immediate halt of immigration by Muslims into nations that do not currently have a Muslim majority population. Find that one rather intriguing.
Yes, indeed. With the Western nations that we normally think of, I'm talking about European nations and the UK, where the populations of Muslims, although they're growing, they're by no means anywhere close to the 40 or 50% mark. I would say you would need to take that further and say halt immigration by Muslims into nations that have Muslim populations far less than 50%. We should be looking at halting immigration into countries that have populations far lower. Because if a country has a Muslim majority population, then it's already lost, really, from a civilizational point of view. Once you get past the 30 or 40% mark, there's very little that you can do to stop the levels of Muslim violence that you see in most Middle Eastern countries and Muslim countries around the world. You don't need a Muslim majority population to have a civilization, a society, which is just so unpleasant for non-Muslims to live in that they just don't want to live there. So the problem is really anything over 15 or 20%, you should be stopping it straight away and not waiting until you've got a Muslim majority population before you apply that test. So that's
oh, absolutely. And I have spoken on the Red Fox Blogger numerous times about the four stages of Islamic conquest, and I quote from Civilis Defendus in that he explains exactly what the conquest of the stages mean and when they reach a certain percentage and what happens down the road. And unfortunately, we're seeing that in Europe in particular. We're seeing that in Sweden. Norway is having real issues. Obviously, England is having real issues, thus the English Defense League, of which I'm a proud supporter of. And it's not only the populace that they are capable of overriding in terms of having children, because they do have large families, but it's the ideology as well that it entails, in that they come over here, and getting back to our points about Sharia, Tim, that they do carry the ideology in that this is how I grew up and this is how I'm going to live my life and I'm going to do it in the West whether you like it or not. This is the ideology. It's very easy to get a sniff test, like, oh, do you believe in beating your wife? Oh, no, you know, I don't do that sort of thing. No.
Yes, then you
read articles where, well, oh, Ayanna killed my four daughters because they were becoming too Westernized. These are the people we're importing.
I was going to say, you know, at the moment, you know, if somebody were to put that on their immigration form, certainly at the borders of the United Kingdom, I'm sure somebody would take, you know, and a border official would take one look and say, oh, you've only honour killed four of your daughters, no problem, in you go, but don't do it again. Otherwise, we'll slap you on the wrist.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, that ties into the next question, which is, you know, we can ask people when they come into the country, they want to seek citizenship.
Yeah.
We can ask them if they support Sharia law or ask them if they're in favor of honor killing and investigate their ties. Well, okay, that might work for a few people, but most Muslims, of course, will just lie about it, because anything that involves the that helps the spread of Islam, if you have to lie about it, then that is not something that should impinge on your conscience if you're a Muslim. So if they're asked if they support Sharia law or any of these other horrific things that form part of the Islamic ideology, they are almost certain, you know, if their citizenship or their ability to immigrate into Western countries depends on it, they're almost they're sure to say, Sharia law, mate, I've never heard of it. And even if I had heard of it, I wouldn't support it because it sounds horrible. So you just know that's what they're going to say. Citizenship, on the other hand, is such a fragile and precious thing that it should not be taken for granted by anybody. And certainly, if you subscribe voluntarily to an ideology which teaches these terrible things, there's a very good case for having your citizenship revoked and your ability to vote and elect local and national officials should be revoked. Which is to say, if you are a Muslim and you voluntarily subscribe and you haven't publicly apostatized, then you should not be given citizenship, because as a Muslim, your loyalty is first and foremost not to the country you reside in, to the Islamic Ummah. So I would say, as another thing that, although I'm sure it would be very contentious and we get people on the left standing up and shouting discrimination, racism, Islamophobia, and so on, citizenship is so precious and so much depends on the trust that's involved between people who live in a country. I mean, before Muslims came along, citizens of a country, by and large, could trust each other in their daily business. You go down the road and you meet people in the course of your employment or in business or in any other walk of life. When you, as soon as you walk out the front door, anybody you interact with, you've got a basic bond of trust with, because if they're a citizen of your country, there's a certain kinship you feel with them. You cannot feel that way with Muslims, not if mm-hmm. you value your life, because they are programmed by the ideology of Islam to smile in your face while their hearts curse you. Now, that's I think that's from a hadith, which a reference I don't have immediately in front of me, but it's perfectly acceptable for a Muslim to do that, to smile.
Oh, absolutely, and you're right. That ties perfectly into point 10, and that is AFDA calls for laws providing that anyone seeking citizenship in the West, the United States in particular, should be asked if he or she supports Sharia law and investigated for ties to pro-Sharia groups. If so, citizenship should not be granted. So we just covered that one beautifully.
Yep. Yep.
Now, point 11, AFDI calls for the cancellation of citizenship or permanent residency status for anyone who leaves the country of his residence to travel for the purpose of engaging in jihad activity and for the refusal of reentry into his country of residence after that jihadist activity.
Yeah, well, that's a no-brainer, really. I mean, we see the crazy situation in the United Kingdom, and I'm pretty sure you could point to examples in different parts of the world, Canada and the United States included, but we have, we know, or our intelligence services know, of hundreds of British-born Muslims who have gone to Syria for the purpose of engaging with jihad activity. And are they likely to be refused re-entry into this country
mm-hmm.
on that jihad activity? Not at the moment. The Home Secretary seems to be quite happy with allowing people to go abroad, reinforce their ideology through means of jihad activity, and then come back maybe with weapons training, maybe even with the contacts that allow them to get hold of weapons once they are back in the country and commit acts of jihad here. Does the Home Secretary here have a problem with it? No. Does the Home Secretary have a problem with allowing people like Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller into England? Most certainly. And it's a totally crazy, crazy situation.
And this brings us, it's total mass Islamity. And let's move on to a point, let me see, where are we? 18, 17, 16, 15, 14, 13. Point,
we'll have to rattle through
point
the
12.
Yeah,
yeah,
on.
Let's move on to point 12. And AFDI calls... Calls for careful investigation of Muslim residents in non-Muslim countries who have obtained naturalized citizenship or permanent residency status to ensure that the status is not obtained under false pretenses. And this is tying back into so many of the points that we're covering already in that, how do you vet a jihadist?
We can have all the
immigration handbooks in the world, but how do you vet a jihadist?
Well, there are systems in place in the United Kingdom, and I'm pretty sure they exist in other countries. We call it in the UK, we call it positive vetting. And what you do is you go back in very close detail. And to get security clearance for some jobs in the United Kingdom, you have to be positively vetted. And that means that somebody is tasked with going back through all your background, which could go back to right when you were at school and talking to your teachers at school and talking to maybe some friends surreptitiously or in previous employers, or getting information from all sorts of areas and forming a picture of whether you are a likely person to to first of all be suitable for whatever it is they're vetting for, but it also can uncover things that were obtained in this case under false pretenses. There are ways and means that the security apparatus in various Western countries can look quite deeply into your background to determine whether or not that's the case. And I would say that process ought to be applied to every single Muslim in this country who has obtained naturalized citizenship or permanent residency status. I mean, ultimately, you might need to keep a very close eye on people who were born here if they choose to continue to subscribe to the Islamic ideology. But in this particular article from AFDI, they are just talking about people who've obtained naturalized citizenship or permanent residency status.
Mm-hmm.
So a very high level of positive vetting might well uncover a significant amount of people who fall into that category. So, yeah, I mean, that should be done. That's a no-brainer. But the apparatus exists to do this. We have the security services who can already do it. It's not like it's something that new that we'd have to think up or a new department we'd have to create. I mean, we might have to employ more people and train more people so that we could cover the volumes of Muslims that would need to be vetted. But, you know, that cost could be recouped. I mean, how about a mosque tax, you know, a yearly licensing tax on every mosque in order to cover the additional security services wages that we have to pay because of Muslims in our countries? That would be nice, wouldn't it? A sort of reverse form of jizya. Now, I'd go along with that. What about you?
Oh, exactly. And you know what? I mean, all these points are tying into one common denominator, and that is we really do not want Islam on our Western shores, and we're going through all these points, and I think we're covering them quite nicely. And they all kind of tie into each other, like AFDI calls for careful investigation of Muslim residents in non-Muslim countries. Yeah, we've covered that, and it ties into the next point. And that is AFDI calls for the designation of the following as grounds for immediate deportation: fomenting, plotting, financing, attempting, or carrying out jihad attacks, encouraging or threatening or attempting to carry out the punishments Islamic law mandates for apostasy, adultery, blasphemy, fornication, or theft, threatening or attempting or carrying out honor murders, forced marriage, underage marriage, female genital mutilation, or polygamy.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's a no-brainer, really. We should be discarding political correctness and the multicultural ethos that permeates our establishment, certainly in the UK and also in other Western nations, but in particular in the UK I'm thinking of, where Muslims are suspected, or in a lot of cases when they're convicted of doing these things, they are not immediately deported. But in fact, they're given very lenient sentences. And as I've often said, I think you should have a category in law which is being criminal while Muslim, and that should be subject to very harsh penalties indeed. At the moment, if you're criminal while Muslim, it's treated as a mitigating circumstance and not an aggravated circumstance. So, yes, if anybody is found guilty of any of those things you listed, immediate deportation should be the rule rather than the exception. So it's a no-brainer. Political correctness and multiculturalism at the moment stops us from doing it, but we have to overthrow that. But then that's a subject for another day. But yeah, that's pretty straightforward. All you've got to say is, yes, it should be done. It's quite obvious, and it would be an obvious thing to do if our establishment weren't so bound hand and foot with the political correctness and multiculturalism I've just mentioned.
And there you go. I think that we have to really start rethinking our embracement of these immigrants into the Western nations, because as we know that we've seen far too many cases where the honor killings and the female genital mutilation, and I know in England in particular, Tim, that what they would do is that they would take their children on a summer vacation to Pakistan and pack your bag, kids. And what they're doing now is that they're pooling all their money together and importing these cutters into the country, into England.
Oh yes, I mean I'm not saying it's an easy thing to uncover or to punish, but nevertheless we should be making it as difficult as possible for Muslims to carry out these practices in this country and make it quite clear that if they are convicted, it's not just going to be a £50 fine and a slap on the wrist. It's going to mean immediate deportation, and if that includes the compulsory confiscation of all your worldly goods that you have in this country that the authorities can lay their hands on to meet the what should be horrendously high fines associated with this process of deportation as well.
Yeah.
You've only got to do that on a small number of occasions, and you are going to see a change in the behaviour of Muslims who will look at this and they'll say, maybe this isn't such a good country for us to carry out our traditional Islamic practices after all. And if that makes them feel that they might be more comfortable in another country, then so much the better. Again, our Western multiculturalists will be shouting and screaming, this is racism, bigotry and Islamophobia, and so on and so on and so on. But the discrimination is necessary. We are going to have to discriminate. There's no way around it. People might say, well, discrimination is wrong per se. I would say it's not wrong per se. There are certain circumstances under which discrimination may be wrong. For example, we are mostly in agreement that it's wrong to discriminate against somebody purely on the color of their skin. That's absolutely fine. But it's the ideology behind what's in people's minds and whether or not they follow up on that ideology that should be the deciding factor. And we have to discriminate against that, because if we don't, we are going to be overrun. And the civilization which has stood us in such good stead for all these years and for which our ancestors and forebears fought and died for, that will be completely swamped and taken over. And the thing is, our civilization is so much better than anything Islam has to offer.
Yeah, and what I'm going to do, though, right now is that I'm going to take a very short break because I think Jan Rennie is here, but she's showing up on a funny number, so I want to take a bit of a break and give us a chance to everybody a chance to refresh their teas and see if that's Jan I have on the line. I believe we have Jan's guest, and that would be Sam with us as well. So I'm going to take a very quick break, Tim, and see if the folks are here.
Okay.
But what I'm going to do, ladies and gentlemen, is I'm going to let you know that Tim and myself are panelists over at...
If you are sick and tired of listening to the lies you hear from politicians and the mainstream media about Islam, and you want to hear the truth about the crimes that are committed in its name in your country and all around the world, then please tune in to the East Anglian EDL radio show on blogtalkradio.com on Thursdays, Fridays and Sundays at 8:30 GMT and 3:30 EDT. For analysis, updates and news about Islam without any of the lies and political correctness that you hear in the mainstream media, and for updates, news and information about the English Defence League, then come and join us on Blog Talk Radio. You can also listen to all our previous broadcasts at any time by visiting the East Anglian EDL Radio Show archive. the East Anglian EDL radio show, the official radio show of the English Defence League.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Red Fox Blogger. And just to remind you, your hosts are Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. As you know, we have started a brand new, exciting segment on the Red Fox Blogger. Once a month, Jan Rennie of the Christian Defense League will be joining us to share her insights and ideas about Islam. I have Jan with me right now. It is my honor to bring Jan on. Jan, hello, and
hello,
welcome
Kel.
To the Red Fox Blogger.
Tim.
How are you?
Hello, Jan. Hello, Jan.
Hi, Tim. I'm fine, thank you, and thank you so much for giving us this slot on your blog, Kel.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we have a very interesting person on tonight. Let me speak first about what we're going
yes.
to do.
Sam is right here, yes.
That's good, hello. It's about the infiltration of terrorists back into their homeland from Syria. That's what we're going to be covering. And indeed, we have a Syrian patriot with us, and thank you so much for being with us. So good evening to you. And we welcome you to the first show of English Defence League in this spot, and thank you for taking part. We're so grateful that we're getting some inside knowledge of Syria, because it has been so well hidden. I do know, I found out earlier this week that the international committee have sanctioned the killing of all terrorists from the Middle East. But it's okay, the EU, they can come home, which means Britain and the rest of the EU, they can come home. These terrorists are welcomed back. But the Middle East do not want their people back, these terrorists, these murderers. So they've been given permission by the International Committee to kill them. I find this most extraordinary, but it is true, it is fact. So what I want to do now is speak to the Syrian patriots. I mean, with CDL, you see, as I've said to you before, but this is for people who have never heard before, Kel, we have many people contact us in Christian Defence League, not all on the page, but via private messages. And we have lots of people. They're not all Christians. We have Jewish people, we have Muslims, and we have people of no faith whatsoever. And, of course, we speak to them. It's our duty to speak to them, you know. And people have to hide and show their concerns, and they leak information to us. Of course, we haven't got links to this information, so we can't broadcast it everywhere, because people would say, that's BS, or if you have no link, we don't want to hear it. But we're getting it word of mouth, you know. So when we had this opportunity to speak to this Syrian patriot,
uh-huh.
and we asked him to come on the show, I mean, it's a brave thing to do for one thing, but it's, you know, it's fact and out of the horse's mouth. So I am so grateful that he is here. And my first question to him is, we know that there's a Geneva conference in January of 2014, and I would like to ask what he is expecting will happen after this conference. Over to you.
Good evening, Jan. Thank you so much for inviting me to your program.
You're very welcome, and we're very much appreciative of your talk.
Yes. I would like, as a Syrian, to give you and to your listener an idea on the global war being waged against the Syrian people.
Yes.
And it has been done by the media that played the dirtiest game against Syria. In fact, it started with 300 media channels were being played and paid by Qatar and Saudi Arabia to report day and night about the Syrian army killing the Syrian people. It was organized actually many years ago. It didn't just happen. It just was a plan to destroy actually the Syrian country and to prepare the world against the Syrian army that he is killing the Syrian people. So that is how really it started to start with.
Yeah.
And about actually the Geneva, well, I mean, it is a show actually. It has been already prepared by the American and the Russian that they have agreed on many things. And it is like a matter of interest to each country who's going to have the bigger piece of the cake. And because of the geopolitical strategic where Syria is on the Mediterranean, and it's also because Syria is not under the American control. So that is what they are going to plan to do. And the rest of the Syrian parties, it will be like the government and the other, there's too many of the opposition. Well, the opposition that they continue saying that they are speaking on behalf of the Syrian people. Well, many of the Syrian people don't know who they are, and I don't know how they put them there.
Who are these opposition parties?
Sorry?
Who are these opposition parties that's vying for power?
Well, the opposition party are, some of them, they are belonging to the Qatari and the Turks. Some of them are Muslim, the Qatari, they have the Muslim Brotherhood, actually. And now the other one, they are paid by the Saudi, which they say that they are speakers of, we don't know, I mean, speakers of the Syrian people, but one of them, the leader, which we know about, he was a shepherd. He used to sell cigarettes in the street. 90% of them we don't know. I mean, 10% of them, that they are supposed to be from the opposition in Syria, that they want to come to Geneva, they are not allowing them because they don't want them to speak what the Syrian wants. But 90% of the one are now in Ankara, in Turkey, and some of them are in Doha, are really, we don't know anything about them. And
so one of the leaders is an ex-street trader. Is that what you mean by he sold cigarettes in the street?
Yeah.
And
he's nobody.
He's a rich guy put there for a purpose.
Well, he was, yes, exactly. I mean, he will do exactly what the Qatari want or the Saudi want or the Turkey want. It got nothing to do what the Syrian people want. What do they have of an opposition? We don't know them. They fight with each other. They change them every couple of months if they don't do what they want to do. And they are taking money. They are paying them millions just to be there. As the recent meeting with the American ambassador was in Syria. They met with them in Ankara, and he told them, either you do what I'm telling you to do, or the same way we made you, we will finish you. I mean, that was the American ambassador.
Yes.
So
yes.
Imagine what is an opposition talking in the name of the Syrian people, in the name of 23 million people. The American ambassador is talking to them in this way.
And this is a street trader who's representing people, and the people don't even know him. And
I mean, he was nobody. He was nobody. Nothing. There's many of them there.
So this is one that you know about. So what about the rest of the people that you don't know about? Who are they? Shepherds? Are they just ordinary traders?
You know, some of them, they were out of the country because they've had criminal charges. Some of them are, I mean, hardly to find any politician. I mean, there is a few. I won't say all, but there is few of them. I mean, there is one, for example, in Paris. He's a lecturer. His name is Mr. Manna. He is quite good. He understands. But they are not inviting him because he wasn't. He did not accept any money from any government. So they are not happy with him.
So, I mean, Syria is a secular country. You all live peacefully together, don't you? You know,
we
all
are
of you,
a secular
country.
Yes, we always, for all these years, we've been living together. You know, Christian, Druze, Kurds, Muslims, you name it. I mean, but we have the oldest church in the world that they still speak the Jesus Christ Aramaic. And they, this army that they are talking about, they attacked this place, this church. And in fact, we were surprised that, you know, I mean, the world, the Western world did not do anything. And they are all these thugs, these terrorists are all under the American, which, you know, under the Saudi and the Qatari. But these two countries are under the power of the American. They didn't say anything. We were shocked as people. We always lived side by side. Even we have Jews in the country. We live side by side. We never speak about, you know, you are Christian or Muslim or anything. They are trying to put this war to make it look like this so they will justify what they are doing. And many countries, they were trying, they are offering the Christian to leave Syria. It wasn't that the Christian refused. I mean, of the Christian and the priests, they were on television refusing these ideas to leave their original country. And it's all because of what is the American are trying to do is to break Syria down and to show the world that, you know, the Syrian army is killing the Christians, which is not true at all. There is in the army, they die in this war, Christian as well.
Yeah, this Al-Nusra and various other rebel groups.
Yeah. Well,
could you explain to us who they are?
Ah, okay.
And who they represent?
Ah, well, we have the Syrian Free Army, the Free Syrian Army. We have Al-Nusra. And we have, I don't know if you heard of this one, is Daesh. Daesh is also a third group now entered into the scene about 6-7 months ago, which is the most dangerous one. They are all from Chechnya, Saudi Arabia. You have them from America, from England. They are all paid. I mean, Al-Nusra is Muslim Brotherhood. They belong. They are supported by the Qatari, and the Syrian Free Army. Actually, there were a lot of people wanted by the law in Syria. There were really about 60,000, and these they been brought and financed by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and they were trained in Turkey. And because they were murderers and killers, and most of them, and they made from them a Free Syrian Army. The second one came into the scene is Al-Nusra. They are Muslim Brotherhood. They also came from, we have nearly about 90 countries, people from 90 countries are fighting in Syria. I mean, there is some American, some English, some Chechnya, they are most from Chechnya, and, you know, they belong to like Muslim Brotherhood. They're all coming for the money. And yes. Then the most dangerous one is this one, Daesh, that it is prepared by the Saudi ambassador was in the United States. His name is Bandar bin Sultan. And he sent them to Syria because it became like, the Saudi and the Qatari promised United States that they can overthrow al-Assad within 2 months and 3 months. And when they couldn't, so they prepared another army, which nearly, they say, I'm not sure of the number, but in the region of 100,000 murderers, we call them, to enter via Jordan and Turkey to Syria to kill the Syrian people. And, we are having a global war, and this really, it's becoming like, the West is trying to make Syria pay a price because Syria did not accept the One World Order. I mean, Assad has refused Colin Powell in the past to cut relations with Iran, and they promised Assad to be the leader of all this area of Jordan, Iraq, and Saudi, to be one of the most important leaders. He said, I will not cut any relation, I will not obey your order. So Syria is paying a price that the American don't like, They wanted one world order, and then suddenly they said that it's going to change. It's not going to be America leading the whole world. And I don't know what they're going to do with all these murderers and criminals that they are trained in Turkey.
Ours can come back. I mean, we don't want them, but the EU and Britain have said, yes, they can come back. That's a different case of the Middle East. They don't want them back, do they?
Yeah, no, because I'll tell you what happened. Few of the European intelligent, they went to Syria under very secret mission now you will start hearing that the European and the American are going to fight terrorism in Syria. They came, they spoke with the Syrian government, three European countries, three people from secret intelligence from three different European countries, to agree with the Syrian to kill them in Syria and not to allow them out. And they gave them the go-ahead. And that's why you see a lot of, movement from the Syrian army, because they are trying to cut all the logistic help and via satellite. To tell them where the Syrian army is moving. So when they are cutting this, they are now planning that they have to finish these people. I mean, they are African, they are European.
Yes. They know too much, and now they've not got the help. So these terrorists obviously know they're out on a limb now. They obviously have realized that they've been betrayed.
I mean, they would
by the people that employed them, by the people that employed them to carry out these murders and massacres. And now the media the media are now saying that the Syrian army are committing massacres. They are not. They have been told to clear up their country now after they came in and tried to just destroy everywhere in Syria. Now tell me something.
I tell you about, I just mentioned about when they said that the Syrian army has used chemical weapons against his people. There is a sister. Her name is Agnes. She's Syrian. She is very well known. She had a proof of the terrorists that they have used the chemical, and she have a proof, and she's going to Lahai to tell them that it wasn't the Syrian, it was the terrorists that they have used it, and she have photograph of the terrorists giving injection to children. She said it on television.
Oh, my Lord.
That they were, so they will look like they are dead.
Goodness
I mean, that is, and they are saying everything, before any meeting, any international meeting, you find out that there is a massacre in Syria. They do it to blame the Syrian army.
Yes,
I am not trying to defend the government. I'm with my army that he is protecting us as civilian. Mm-hmm. He's protecting our country from these murderers.
You have 23 million in the population in Syria. Who do they support and why?
Okay. I will not say as Syrian, but the CIA, they have come to like counting, or I don't know how they said, in Carnegie something place where they make about who's going to win and who's going to lose. They found out that 70% of the people, they support the president.
Yes.
And we do. Before, it was in the beginning, if it was, I am saying we have corruption, we have bad things, we have good things, we have whatever. But on the other hand, we don't want our country to be destroyed. So they are trying to bring down Assad, whether the people like it or not. So in the beginning, there was some people were against this government. But after what they have seen of massacre, and after what when they have seen these terrorists are shelling schools of children, and they are aiming recently, the last month, a lot on the Christian areas, everybody is supporting Assad because he is now, they know now, this is all, it's a global thing against Syria.
They wanted a global war in Syria.
And I tell you seriously, 70%, I say, is with Assad.
I can believe that. I think that we all knew that from the, you know, from day one. So none of us was fooled as to what was going on. And as much as we could.
Jan, there was 300 media channels against Syria. It suddenly came out day and night reporting about Syria, and all to prepare the whole world that, you know, the Syrian army. Why should the Syrian army kill his people? For what?
Well, they wouldn't. It doesn't make any sense. No. So, what is the president doing to protect the religious minorities and the ethnic community in your country?
Well, I tell you, what they are doing, they are really, first of all, there is the Christian area in Damascus, I'm talking, and the Jews area. They are living side by side with the Muslims. But recently, when Damascus was protected, they start shelling these areas from far. And the president, and even 3 days ago, they bombed the Umayyad Mosque, which is one of the famous things in Syria, the Umayyad Mosque. You look at the at television, which they are not allowing the Syrian news to come out. Priests and sheikhs and Druze, they are all together, hand by hand, refusing these things. They are meeting the president. They are with the president. You go and ask the Christian people. You look on the Facebook. All the Christian, more than the Muslim, are with President Assad because he protects them like they are part of our life. We cannot, be without. It's a secular country. We have the Jews, we have the Christian, we have the Druze, we have the Kurds. We all live together. We never had these problems. We never had any problem.
I have seen this in the pages. I have got so many pages I'm linked to regarding Syria. And I don't know what religion they are. I don't care what religion. There is so much unity.
Oh, yeah.
Even talking to each other. And they're talking in English a lot so that we on the outside can see this. And there is so much unity. It's unbelievable. You know,
I tell you, Jan, believe me, I mean, if you go into Syria and you go to ask any, whatever religion you want to ask, they will tell you we never had a problem. We never,
you just live normally.
We just live side by side. We never ask what religion are you or what you believe in God or you don't believe in God or you believe in Christ or you believe in... We never ask. never,
no,
ever asked
but
this
the West,
question, or we never had
Western,
anything.
They just want Syria. They wanted to break down Syria.
They want to destroy it. Exactly.
And they need the truth. We need the truth. We need the facts. Who's going to publicize that the international community allowed or have sanctioned the killing of these terrorists that they...
They're
never going to admit that.
No, I'm telling you, they came and exactly, you know, a meeting was with very high intelligence Syrian army for 15 minutes. You know, the Syrian first told them, you know, forget it. We will not obey by any rules. Then they told them, okay, you put what you want and we will agree on it. These three European countries, they don't want them back. They want them to be massacred in Syria.
Right. But ours can come back. And that's what we're thinking. Infiltration of these terrorists from Syria are coming back here. Accepted as normal people. Walking amongst us. They've had the taste of blood. They've been massacring people, chopping people up. You know, using chemical weapons on them. What do we want them back here for? We don't need them back here.
If you go back, Jan, the president, President Assad, told the European country, they will be back to your countries.
He
warned them from the beginning. You are sending them. The intelligence, the American intelligence in Turkey, they train them highly. They are very well trained.
Yes.
They are suicidal. They are cutting hands. They are committing massacre. So,
yes.
I don't know. They told them they will be back. And now they said that you will start hearing, we are going to fight terrorism in Syria. But you send these terrorists to Syria.
I have They send them in
hundreds of thousands. And I don't know what they're going to do because they are training them. There is this security company that they were in Iraq, like Blackwater.
Yeah.
They are training them. They are animals.
Yes, of course.
They kill, they do anything. I mean, that is what's going to happen.
Yes. Now, we've seen videos, two or three of them, from inside Syria, and they've been passed out by the rebels. They've had the cameramen there as well, and I mean, the one I saw, it was in a cellar, it was quite dark, and the children were very, very distressed and screaming while these rebels were chopping off arms and legs of the fathers, uncles, whatever. And
I didn't
watch the end. I had to switch it off. And these videos are getting out, and it's like trophies. They're treating these videos as trophies. These are madmen, uncontrollable madmen that they've unleashed in Syria.
Yes.
And now,
Jan,
Syria has this problem.
You will see many of them. There's plenty of them. Actually, the people from the terrorists are selling these videos to the Syrian media for money.
Shocking.
They are doing
it
and they are filming it. So, I mean, you will see many. There is a lot of massacres. And all for money.
Yes. So, you know, I mean, where do we go from here? Where do we go from here when they're coming back into our country? Are they just waiting around until they decide to send them somewhere else? To try and
well,
down
I mean, they are now, I'll tell you, this Daesh, these are the dangerous ones. They are on the border with Turkey. So now we have...
Are there any...
Daesh is now a very big group, all terrorists, I mean, highly trained, paid by Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador was, and now he's the head of the secret intelligence in Saudi Arabia. He prepared this army to attack Syria, and they are based in Turkey. And now they went into on the border with Turkey and Syria. They are financed by Saudi Arabia. Now, there's going to be three battles. One is going to be in the mountain of Al-Qalamun between Syria and Lebanon. And the second one is going to be in Aleppo. And the third one is going to be on the border with Turkey. So Turkey now, they are building a wall that they don't want them anymore. So they will not allow them in.
How many do you think will hide under the guise of refugees?
Well, there are. There is many.
They're claiming status as refugees.
Oh, yes, they can be.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have, I don't know, bodies of English people. Their crops are there in Syria. They have them. They know the English knows about them. The English government knows about them. A lot of people has been killed there. The French people, they know. The German people, they know.
Yes.
They know that they have them, but they will be back. There's quite a few of them. I'm not sure the English are 200 or 400.
Probably 400. They'll all be coming home now, you know. I mean,
yes.
They could arrest them at the airport. They know where they're coming from. If they're coming from Turkey or they're coming from anywhere in the Middle East,
they know them. They know them because they allow them out.
Yeah.
They know them. When they went to Turkey to be trained. They know their name. They trained them in Turkey by the American and the British and the Turks. They've been trained in camps in Turkey. They know one by one if they want to pick them up, but they are trying to finish them in Syria. And that is now the scenario, is that they are going to help Syria in fighting terrorism. So they are giving them the green light, okay, kill them. But, I mean, some of them have left. Even if you see that the Chechenian president said, that he said 2 days ago, if these Chechenians come back to Chechnya, I will shoot them myself. The one they are stealing, killing, raping in Syria. That is the president of Chechnya.
Do you think they were recruited from maybe a prison?
Or they were prison? Recruited what?
From, like, Chechnya. These are murdered.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and so they probably came from prisons. For that
prison. Many of now the Saudis sent all their prisoners to us. Some, they came from Guantanamo. Some came from Chechnya. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
that's why they will not allow. They cut the Syrian media from Europe, so they will not see the truth. They don't want the European people to see the truth. What's going on? And when they catch somebody and they put them on television, they don't want the European to see and to hear what they have done.
It's astonishing, and none of this will ever be reported. So we can only be so thankful to you. I've heard this through PMs and different sources of things that's been going on, and I don't know whether you want to come in here, Cal and Tim, and just have a brief, because we're due to be finished in a couple of minutes anyway. Excuse me. Cal, are you there?
Yes.
Tim?
I am.
Well, I'm certainly here. Go on, Cal. Yes. I'll let you take that one up.
Oh, no. Tim, please go ahead, because what I've been doing is that I've been in the bubble, and I've been missing a little bit. So, Tim, go ahead and cover.
Oh, I don't know, Cal, what you like. Well, first of all, it's nice. It's nice to speak to you, you, Jan, and it's nice to meet you, Sam. And it's most interesting to get your point of view from somewhere in the world where we know Well, I suppose you can say in any war, the first casualty is the truth. So I suppose in some respects, a lot of what you're saying is not all that surprising. But of course, we never hear this. We never hear the truth from somebody who's as close to the situation as somebody like you. So it's a real, real eye-opener. And it's a real privilege to have you on a show like this so that you get a chance to express your views. And I'm certainly very grateful to Jan for allowing bringing you on and sort of allowing you to speak in a way that is so free, because obviously there are parts of the world where if you were to express those opinions that you have, you wouldn't last very long at all. So it's good of you to come here and to tell us, give us this side of the story, because it's something we'd never normally hear. Good to hear you.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, and now I can jump back in and say, Sam, that I am also conveying my gratitude that you would be able to come on Jan's segment of the Red Fox Blogger and join us. You are just absolutely enthralling. You're very fascinating. And I was just vetting a call in the green room, so I was missing the last little part of it there. But I heard...
Thank you very much.
Conversation. Jan, good job. Kudos. That's what I have to say. And back to Jan
and
her segment.
The thanks really goes to our Syrian patriot, because it's people like him that have been getting snippets out. And as I said, if we don't have a link, we can't really produce it in any of the groups or the pages, because it could be hearsay. But we know this is going on. And sometimes we're getting pictures from Syria with just a little explanation. I do post them on. I have to, because I know that they're real. We know that this is going on in Syria. And a lot of the people at the beginning were quite confused as to what was going on in Syria. And so a few of us was putting them right, and then they all cottoned on to this unbelievable attack within a country that... And what astonishes me, Cal, is that the UK government, when they were invited by OB to join in this war, only 13 votes saved us from going to war. 13 votes. I can't remember the exact figures. It was something like 273, and then eyes to the left and nose to the right and all this business. So there's only 13 votes against a war. And that's what's frightening. Thank God. Thank God that happened. You know? Because
I think it would have been a huge, huge mistake for Britain to get involved. Because for one thing, it's the situation is extremely confused on the ground. And for another thing, whenever the Western powers get involved in something like this in the Middle East, with the best will in the world, they often end up causing far more problems than they actually solve. I mean, you only have to look at how the Arab Spring has turned out in some of the other Middle Eastern countries as to see the truth of that statement. So, yes, it's true. It was a very close call. And it would have been a tragedy, I feel, if we had got involved at this stage. I mean, nobody likes to see innocent people dying on the ground in Syria. But once something like that starts, you can't necessarily say.
These leaders have no integrity. Leaders have no integrity.
Well,
they are
looking
big on the faces, and they haven't the principle to put their hands up and say, we did this all wrong. We should never have done
quite.
It.
Well, quite.
They're too busy passing the buck on to someone else. They're still being deceitful.
Well, that's politicians for you, Jan.
Yes, exactly.
Welcome to the real world.
Yep.
But, I mean, in all seriousness, I think if we'd got involved, it would have made a bad situation that much worse. And, you know, like I say, nobody wants to see innocent people being killed on the ground, but once you've actually got that situation there to bring in the Western powers and try and get them to aid one side or another when the situation is so confused, I don't see how we could have done anything that we could have looked at and put our hands on our hearts and said that was the right thing to do at this stage. So I'm very glad that we didn't get involved. But yeah, I mean, my heart goes out to all those Syrians that are there right in the middle of it on the ground, Sam. And, you know, I know it's a terrible situation, and I guess all we can really do at the moment is just pray that it's resolved before too many more people get killed, because I know it's claimed the lives of like hundreds of thousands of people, or, well, over 100,000 people, I believe the figure is, and it's something nobody likes to see.
Sam, I've had a request that you come back on with me next month if you'd like to do that.
Hello, Sam, you there? You might have lost him temporarily, Jan.
I think we've lost him. I'll try.
Yeah, unfortunately, Sam's call dropped off.
Okay. So that about wraps it up. I'm going to leave it to you two now, Cal and Tim. You can just carry on now. I thought that was a very interesting program, and thank you so much from the Syrian Patriots for coming on.
Jan, thank you so very, very much for doing
it,
your
it
segment
happen,
here on
yeah.
Red Fox Blogger, and thank you so very much for your guest, Sam. It was fascinating. The chat room was just jumping. It was very exciting to listen to Sam. You really brought a lot to the table today. We want to thank you.
Yes,
no,
indeed,
thank you for having
I second that.
We don't have a Christian voice across the West. You know, well, we certainly don't have it across the world when you think about it, but the West, they're just ignoring the Christians. You know, everything is for everyone else but the Christians. They're being killed, murdered, sacrificed for what? We need a Christian voice. We need a politician to stand up for the Christians.
Indeed we
do.
Yeah, indeed we
but
do.
I'm going to leave you now, and thank you so much for having the CDL on your blogspot, Kel. And thank you, too.
Jan, we are so looking forward to having you back, and we hope that Sam comes back as well.
Yes, indeed.
You are just fantastic.
I'll talk to you.
And I always look forward to my Sunday evening calls with you.
Okay. Thank you so
okay.
much, the two of you. Bye-bye.
You bet.
Cheerio then, Jan.
Cheers, Jan. And ladies and gentlemen, that was Jan Rennie of the Christian Defense League, and she was conducting an interview with Sam from Syria. Jan is going to be a regular monthly fixture here on the Red Fox Blogger on Mondays, the first Monday of every month, and Jan will be back in January, the first Monday of January. So please, always mark your calendars and listen to our dear Jan. She is another dedicated counter-jihadist, and it is just an absolute pleasure that the Red Fox Blogger can give her a forum to speak and to share with you what is going on, not only in England, but in the Western world in general. And Tim, we're down to our last 4 minutes.
Yes, I know. I mean, if you're going to stay on for a little while in archive, Kel, I'll stay with you and we can chew over the last four or five items.
You know what? I was going to ask you if you would like to do that.
Yeah,
go
I'd very much like
to. Because I still have that window open. And good thing Michelle's not here, because she would be giving me troubles. Shut those windows, Kel. We're freezing. But what I'm going to do then is I'm going to play us out. And ladies and gentlemen, if you want to listen to the rest of the program, Tim and I, we're going to go over an archive. And we are going to finish discussing the 18-point counter-jihadist plan. But one thing I do want to do is thank everybody who joined us in the chat room, and that is Dodgy Dave, Jeff from East Anglian EDL Radio Show, Eric Kyle, we have some guests in here, Luchadora, Michael Kaplan, Joel, Paul Alexander, Poppy, Rem Soldier, and Dito Esposito, Mamma Mia, No Sharia, who has a show tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Radio Jihad Network right here. So join us there and chat later on. I want to thank people who are listening on other devices, and so does Tim. I want to thank 937 for listening in and enjoying the program. You guys are absolutely fantastic. Of course, I'll be back again on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, but also listen on Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where the host here at the Red Fox Blogger is Mike Holt of Restore Australia. And on Thursday, we have a special with Randy L. Noble, The Cross in the Desert, on Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. So mark your calendars, folks. Hey, Tim, do you want to say goodnight?
Yeah, good night, everybody. Thanks for being with us tonight. And if you listen in archive, we'll be picking up the rest of those points on the 18-point plan. So hope you can join us later. So bye for now, and don't forget to drop into the Red Fox Blog, Red Fox Blogger, next Monday, and also on the show on Friday, and of course East Anglia on Thursdays, Fridays, and Sunday evenings. At 08:20:30 GMT. I nearly said 08:30 GMT.
And just to remind you, when you go to a Jeff Mitchell show at the East Anglian EDO radio show, bring a spider. He loves them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, are you in trouble, Kel? Are you in trouble?
We're so fired. good afternoon, everybody. We'll see you later on.
What does the fox say?
The vixen cry.
Yeah.
Hey, and welcome back, everybody. And guess what? We are into archive, and that is very unusual for the Red Fox Blogger. But we had a very exciting show today. I really do truly want to thank Jan Rennie for being here and bringing such a wonderful guest to the table and contributing to the Red Fox Blogger. Jan will be back. This will be a time slot for her once a month, like I say, the first Monday of every month. So please make sure you do tune in. She's a lovely lady, like I say, a dedicated counter-jihadist like Tim and myself. And Tim, what do you think, eh?
Oh, yeah, it was a most interesting conversation. And it's really nice to get a perspective from somebody whose ear is a little bit closer to the ground than we're ever likely to get with the Syrian conflict. So, yeah, it was most fascinating. I mean, as I was saying, one of the first things about the first casualty of war is the truth. So you can never 100% believe everything that's coming out from a war zone like Syria, especially when it's put out by our mainstream media and our governments. But that guy, his voice had the ring of truth about it, and I absolutely believe what he had to say was true. So it was really nice to get that perspective.
It's it's very interesting to hear these voices from around the world, and Sam was certainly one insightful one. You couldn't see the chat room, but it was just jumping, Tim. I mean, people were, who is this guy? Is he on Twitter? Who is he? They're very animated, very excited. They loved what they were hearing, and he will be back on the Red Fox Blogger with Jan in her segment next month.
Good. Okay, well,
now,
do you want to cover anything else before we went back to this list we were talking about earlier in the show?
Well, yeah, we left off, actually. I want to pick up, before we close out, I did want to finish the list. We were at point 12, and I was, let me see.
I think the last thing we covered was the designation of various offences as grounds for immediate deportation.
That's right.
We got to the point, well, I think my response was that essentially it's a no-brainer.
That was point 13,
and,
that's right.
Yes. It was obvious that anybody who commits these offences, and there was quite a long list, including honour murders, forced marriage, underage marriage, and so on, It seemed to me to be an absolute no-brainer that we shouldn't just be treading softly in the name of political correctness and multiculturalism and cultural sensitivity. We should be treating it very harshly and saying, yeah, not only are you going to have very harsh financial penalties, but there's also going to be the prospect of immediate deportation.
Yeah.
Because these things, you know, if it was just once every now and again, that would be one thing. Our criminal justice system could cope with something like that. But when it's happening on the scale that it is and effectively undermining the entire fabric of our civilization and endangering national security, then much more stronger steps have to be taken. And as I was saying, the left will no doubt shout discrimination,
uh-huh,
racism, bigotry, and Islamophobia, because that's what they always do, but we have to be discriminatory. It's a sad thing, but if we're going to get rid of the very clear and present danger of our civilization being overrun by an alien and hostile ideology, we have to be discriminatory, and there's no two ways about it. It's either that or lose the civilization that we currently have.
The thing is that we were touching on these earlier points, and I was touching upon the procreation rates amongst Muslims. And one thing in this particular point, and that's point 13, is polygamy. And I better make sure I get that right. 18, 17, 16, 15, 14. Yes, we're on 13. But the polygamy issue is very disconcerting to me, because these Muslims, when they emigrate, they come over, of course, with their official first wife, and then all of a sudden they're sponsoring a sister, quote-unquote, or a cousin, quote-unquote. These people come over here, and they're technically unmarried, but they're having children, and they're collecting welfare benefits.
Oh, yeah.
And because they're technically unmarried. And this is how the taxi driver supports his family.
Well, quite. I mean, even if a Muslim comes over and he nominally divorces his wife, okay, so that wife might pick up extra welfare benefits because she's apparently no longer being supported by the husband to the extent that she was. The guy marries again. Repeat that two or three times, and you've got four wives. Of course, they still all live in one household, but each wife is given a full set of, complement of welfare benefits, including no doubt a free flat or a house or some form of accommodation, which is then rented out on the black market. So they're getting an absolute fortune in welfare benefits that they're not entitled to, far in excess of any any earnings that an indigenous Briton might have. If you say the average earnings over here are maybe, I don't know, £25,000 or $40,000, something like that for a typical family, they would have no problem meeting that sort of level at all if you take those welfare fraud factors into account. And of course, the authorities are very, very averse to prosecuting anything like that for fear of being seen as racist or Islamophobic.
A lot of times, too, I don't know how it works in England or in the United States, but in Canada, what they do is that they dispatch their second, third, or fourth wives in separate apartment buildings, and so it's not. They're quite crafty in being circumspect in that sense. We have the cases of the polygamist, Helen Sconce's second wife, in the home with the first wife, as we witnessed with the Shafia mass honor killings. I mean, Muhammad Shafia, when he killed his three daughters and his first wife, they were all living under one roof. But in a lot of cases, they place their other spouses in separate apartment buildings, which makes it kind of hard for the cab driver to get around because he's got to, be with the wife. But Monday is Fatima's turn, and Tuesday is, whoever's turn.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a case not too long ago where a Muslim had just that situation. He'd got four wives parked up in four different apartments around the town. I forget exactly where it was, probably Bradford or I think it was a northern city, but the point is that he had to drive between them. And of course, this was a fair old bit of driving he had to do. And he got caught speeding one time, and he came up before the judge and he said, "Well, Your Honor, it's not my fault really that I was caught speeding, because I have four wives and they live in different parts of the town, and I have to get between them. And if I'm late, they give me, a lot of trouble."
You know what?
So they let him off. They let him off.
And they let him off.
Absolutely. So that's just another example of the two-tier justice system. An aside, really. But the fact is that polygamy gives us all sorts of problems. It's not just the fact that if you've got four wives, can they be said to be treated equally? Well, I guess if they've got the welfare systems to fall back on that we provide them with in this country, it doesn't really matter if the husband doesn't treat them equally, because they get very generous benefits in comparison to what they would get if they were living in somewhere like Pakistan. But of course, if they're each having four, five, six children, that's for the next generation. That's maybe another 25 to 30 children that are going to be brought up with the same ideology, and who will no doubt, if they've got nothing to prevent it happening, they'll be engaging in the same kind of alien and hostile behavior towards the rest of us that this generation currently is. Only next generation, there'll be that many more of them and that many less of us. So it's not rocket science to see where this is leading if we allow it to continue in the way that we have done.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, we should be standing on it.
And it is the ideology. Okay. And I was reading the you posted an article from Jeff's show from yesterday, and that's the East Anglian EDL radio show, about it was from May of 2013, and that was pertaining to the Swedish riots going on over there.
Oh, yes. Now, another country where...
Oh, yeah, but I was reading that article, and Mohammed was stating that, well, you know, things are so different here, and under Swedish law, we can't punish our children, and he meant by that corporal punishment, that we can't discipline our children in that sense, and that's another concern that we have to be aware of. And when I was doing my radio program on Friday night and I was highlighting the issue of Love the Apostate, I brought up the case of that poet. And let me see if I can
Yahya Hassan.
Thank you.
Danish. Yep.
Yes. And he brought up a point about how when he was a child that he was abused and literally was made to stand on one foot with both arms out facing the wall as punishment. That's beyond corporal punishment. And like in the West, when we spank we give our children a little tap on the bottom because they're getting too close to the hot stove, and it's like, okay, we'll maybe slap their hand, and no, danger, don't do that. And that's considered corporal punishment. But what these Muslims actually inflict upon their own children in terms of corporal punishment is just unbelievable. And, of course, I could go back to point 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Let's stick with what we're on right now, and that is point 13, and that is female genital mutilation. Like, it's just the barbarity of the Islamic believability is very. It is foreign to us. However, we're welcoming this in the West. How is it possible that we can be so accommodating to such a alien entity?
Well, as I've probably said before, it is a combination of things. One is the politically correct and multicultural atmosphere, the atmospheric tenets, if you like, that suffuse our environment. So nobody likes to be seen as racist or Islamophobic in their dealings with the Muslim population. And the people who come into contact with the Muslim population are going to be social workers, people in the education system, people in law enforcement, and they are all taught that they have to be politically correct, multiculturally sensitive to the fact that these people are doing things in a different way than we might do them. Well, okay, I mean, if that extends to things like the fact that they put their milk in the tea afterwards rather than before they put the tea in. We can live with differences like that, okay? But when it comes to physically mutilating your children or abuse with corporal punishment, such as you were describing, we have to say we are not going to stand for it. And we have to make some examples so that the Muslim population understands that we're serious about this, and that we are not just going to turn a blind eye and look the other way. And if social workers come into contact with Muslim families and they suspect there has been child abuse of this nature, then it should be their duty to report it so it can be properly investigated. And if they're found to have covered it up, then penalties should apply to them just as much as they should to the Muslim communities that are perpetrating these things. But we have to make it clear that we are serious, because these cultures have no place in these aspects of Islamic culture have no place in civilized countries. And we have to be absolutely really, really harsh on people who transgress those boundaries. And we won't need to be harsh all the time, but we will have to make it quite clear that when we do discover that this is what is happening, that they are punished to the full extent, not only of the laws that we've got at the moment, but laws which I think should be brought in to criminalise these aspects and allow us to apply much harsher punishments than have been applied previously.
I could agree with that. And that kind of moves us into point 14, where AFDI calls for the U.S. and other free nations to have jihad as it is traditionally understood in Islamic jurisprudence to involve warfare against and subjugation of non-Muslims declared a crime against humanity at the U.N. or to withdraw from the U.N. and have its headquarters moved to a Muslim nation. And, of course, this is something that I've been carping on for years.
Well, yes. I mean, we had a whole program devoted to this only a few weeks ago, didn't we? Where we were talking about the UN and how it's been infiltrated by the OIC, the organization. OIC, Organization of Islamic Conference.
Cooperation.
Cooperation.
Their 1618 and their Cairo Declaration. Yes.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, They're hijacking the UN to pass laws
mm-hmm.
which really go against a lot of what Western civilization stands for. But jihad in particular, of course, if you talk to a Muslim, he'll say, well, you do realize that jihad is just sort of striving internally to be a better person. It's an interior spiritual struggle. And, of course, when he tells you that, he's indulging in taqiyya, Toria, Kitman, Maruna, and all the rest of it, insofar as that jihad does mean that, but in terms of the totality of what jihad means in Islamic ideology, it only means that about 3% of the time. 97% of the time, it means physical confrontational warfare against the non-Muslims, against the kuffar. So that's one thing about jihad, yes, and it should be declared a crime against humanity at the UN because
mm-hmm.
at the moment Muslims are running around the world in every country where they have a significant presence, causing all manner of death and destruction through bombs, shooting, killing in the most horrible ways possible, all in the name of Islam and the jihad ideology that underpins it. So yes, we should be making jihad a crime against humanity. And if the UN can't countenance that because they are so compromised and infiltrated by the OIC, we should withdraw from the UN and say, you are no longer fit for purpose. If you wish to continue to operate as a body, we'll move you to as this particular proposal suggests, to a Muslim nation. I think we had Michael Green on a few weeks ago. He said, well, why don't we just move it to France? You know, that would teach them. that would teach them. You know, they'd be good for each other. But anyway, not to be too francophobic about it all, yes, we should say if you can't agree that jihad is a crime against humanity, then we don't need you to behave as a world body on our behalf. Thank you very much. Go and move to a Muslim nation or to France or somewhere like that where you can pass all the laws that you like and they won't have any effect on us in the civilized West.
Well, you know, the thing is that I get very concerned about the OIC in particular, in that the UN is just so saturated with these Islamic states. We call it the Heinz 56 plus one,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
Because they also gave Palestinian a non-vote, although they have no voting capabilities, they are all the same still involved with the UN at this point. And Palestinian, to me, we could go on. I could go off into an entirely different tangent, Tim. But as
well,
far
we,
as I'm concerned,
we
there is no such thing as a Palestinian state.
Well, no.
And this is what the UN is turning
that.
Into. It's turning into a platform for the Islamic nations to push their weight around, and we're talking about 1618, clause 1618.
Well, that's the most pernicious clause that they're trying to push on the rest of us, of course, because that will involve the removal of freedom of speech from the rest of us. If we lose that, if we lose the ability to criticize Islam and everything it stands for, then effectively we're defenseless. So we cannot, under any circumstances, allow them to succeed with that.
No.
Freedom of speech underpins our democracy and our civilization. And if we capitulate on that subject, then that is the beginning of the end of our civilization. And our civilization, as I've said before, it may seem strong and enduring on the surface, but in reality, it is a delicate flower, and it needs protection, and it needs protection from the strong winds and hurricanes, the scorching sunshine, the freezing blizzards, if you like. That's an analogy that I like to use, because if we don't give it the protection that it needs in times like these, then we're very quickly going to find that we're going to lose all the things that our ancestors fought and died for to give us. It's our duty to protect it. They passed the baton of freedom down to us, and it's not enough for us just to say, oh, thanks very much, and put it on a shelf and forget about it. We actually have to defend it from time to time, and this is one of those times. And we all have to stand up and play our part in the defense of that freedom.
I absolutely agree with that. And that, like Claire won, I don't know, this one's kind of, it just sticks with me. The UN in particular. Canada has threatened in the past to leave the United Nations, and I think it should. I think that we should stay with the Commonwealth nation,
well,
as it were.
Yeah. I mean, the concept of the UN when it was originally drawn up, where are we looking at, 1940s, something like that? To replace
1947,
the
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was just after a very catastrophic world war, and obviously there was a lot of motivation to have a world body formed so that differences could be settled inside that world body, so that countries would not have to go to war and expend millions of lives trying to prove a point. And there are wars that have been fought over trivial things. There is wars that have been fought over land, over resources, over ideologies. And the idea was that with the UN, if there was a difference between two or more countries, those differences would be taken to the UN and they would be hammered out.
Apologies. I said 1947. No, the United Nations was created in 1945. And, of course, that makes sense because the World War II ended in 1944. So there you go.
Okay.
I failed math in high school, Tim.
Don't worry about that. I mean, my point was going to be was that in principle it seemed like a good idea, but it does require, whenever you're negotiating in that way, it does require goodwill on behalf of all the parties. And the problem is that when Muslims deal with non-Muslims in their dealings, there is no goodwill at all. There is only scheming on the Muslim side to determine how easily they might get the best of the kuffar. There is no sense of compromise or negotiation or give and take. It's we're going to get what we want at the expense of the kuffar, no matter what it takes. Now, if the Muslim side has got that approach, then trying to deal with them in a spirit of negotiation and compromise will never work, because you, as the non-Muslim side, will end up giving away and making all the concessions, and they'll end up doing all the taking. And in fact, that is what we see whenever you have dealings between Muslims and non-Muslims, whether it's at, well, not so much the individual level, but when you're talking at the country level, and in particular in any kind of negotiations that we've seen over the past decade or two between non-Muslim countries and Muslim countries, the negotiations, funnily enough, always involve concessions from the non-Muslim side, taking from the Muslim side, and if there's any kind of agreement that's reached, it's only temporary because the Muslim side has no intention of sticking to those agreements. They will break them at the first pretext, the first available opportunity. And why shouldn't they? Because they're only following the example of the Prophet Muhammad, who did exactly the same thing throughout his career. And in particular, some of your listeners, some of our listeners may not have heard of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah of 627, but that was a specific example that was referred to by Yasser Arafat in his negotiations when he was alive, and he was criticized by some of his countrymen for coming to an agreement with non-Muslims over the issue of Israel and the surrounding Muslim countries. He said to his countrymen, "Don't worry about anything I might have said to the infidel. I'm treating it in the spirit of Hudaybiyah." And what he meant was that as soon as there was a pretext, he would break any agreement that was made. He would break it on the slightest pretext. And in fact, that's what he did. And he was responsible for, shortly after he said that, I think it was the second intifada that he instigated, even though the non-Muslim countries were willing to make 99% of the concessions that he was asking for to start with. He rejected them. He rejected them and started the second intifada. I think this was back in 2000, purely because he felt that he had no moral responsibility to do otherwise. Any agreement that was made with the Kuffar, he felt he could break with impunity, because that's what the Prophet Muhammad did. So that's the point I'm making. With the UN, you cannot enter into agreements and achieve lasting results, because the Muslim mindset is totally predisposed to something completely different to what you're predisposed to believe when you think you're coming to an agreement. Completely different.
Oh, exactly. And I think that, you know what, Tim? I think you and myself, we could spend an entire episode discussing the UN and its ramifications and what it means to the planet today. It certainly isn't what it is today. It certainly is not upholding its end of why it was created in the first place in 1945. And that is a lot of dissension. There's a lot of people out there who say, get the UN out of New York City and toss that building into the East River.
And
you know what? It's in Lower Manhattan. It's prime real estate, for goodness sake. We could turn that into public housing for the Muslims.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Yes.
There you go.
Or demolishing the whole races on a Friday afternoon.
But moving into point... Oh.
Well,
moving into point 15, though, and this one... And it kind of comes back to what we were discussing at the beginning of the program, and that is the AFDI calls for legislating making illegal the foreign funding of Islamic studies departments in faculty positions in our universities. Well, I would go further and say in our public schools as well. And ladies and gentlemen, please get your kids out of public school. And I like this one. I like it a lot, but I also would expand that we start banning the madrasas in the West as well. For example, the Gulen schools.
Oh, yes, good point. The Gulen schools in particular are teaching, They are certainly following the harsher tenets of Islam, aren't they, if I'm not mistaken? I haven't got a Gulen link up in front of me at the moment, but I do know that they are very, very heavily or very well funded by this guy. What's his first name? Begins with F.
Oh, his name is Mohammed Fethullah Gulen.
Fethullah,
he's from Turkey, and of course he's a Muslim scholar.
Yes, indeed, and he's in a position to put a lot of funding into those schools, and of course what they're teaching is totally contrary to what we would expect children to be taught if they're going to grow up to be good citizens in the West. And that's part of the problem.
Oh,
the next generation, if they grow up to be as alien and as hostile, or to embrace the alien and hostile ideology of Islam in the same way that this current generation seems to be embracing it. And there's three or four times more of them in a generation's worth time, which is to say 15, 20 years, then we're going to have a problem which is going to be much, much bigger than the problem we have now. What we've got is a problem that is fixable in 15, 20 years' time. That may not be the case because the numbers, the demographics are going to be that much more against us. But
yeah.
we can fix this as long as we recognize that, A, we've got a problem, B, that when you're in a hole, you must stop digging, so you must stop making the problem worse, and then you've got to carry out the various steps. I suggest that a lot of the steps that are in this 18-point plan would be very, very constructive if they were implemented in terms of turning back the tide of Islamic encroachment and getting it under control and making it a very much less attractive place for Muslims to be if they want to follow the ideology of Islam. If they want to renounce the ideology of Islam and become apostates and publicly apostatize, we should maybe really encourage that. Give them, if they make a public apology, maybe get it photographed, videoed, posted on YouTube.
Yeah.
So everybody can see that they have publicly apostatized. Maybe we should make that worth their while in financial terms and helping them to rehabilitate themselves and become good, productive citizens in the West. Maybe that's something else we could do. I mean, that one is just off the top of my head right now. But certainly if they don't apostatize and they persist in following what is an alien and hostile ideology that is seeking to undermine our civilization, then we should treat them very harshly indeed and make it very unpleasant for them to carry on living here. And all these steps that are listed in this 18-point plan are designed to make it that little bit more hostile to Muslims who want to follow the Islamic doctrines and the Islamic ideology as it was followed by Muhammad in the 7th century. I think that's what we should be doing. We should not be saying to them, let's be culturally sensitive and accommodate these practices. We should be saying, no, you don't. And if you do follow these practices, you are going to be subject not just to harsh financial penalties, but possibly deportation and all sorts of things which, you know, they would find generally unpleasant. And I think that is certainly one of the things that we could think about.
I cannot agree more. And I really do like this point in that we have to very much criticize and critique, in particular, I suppose I should say, the Islamic studies departments and the faculty positions of these Islamists that come over here and that they hold positions in our Western universities, because they are really bent on twisting the minds of our next generation, as it were. I'm very critical of Islamic studies. It's really, really bad. And as we were touching upon earlier in the program, and I was bringing up the issue of, and you were bringing up the issue as well, of our public school children being taken to, oh, for goodness sake, being taken to a day trip to engage in Explore Islam Day, like, for goodness sake.
Yeah, an Islamic workshop. I mean,
yeah.
it's one thing teaching children the truth about Islam. First and foremost, children of that age, I should think, should have before they are exposed to Islam, they should have a thorough grounding in the history, traditions, and values of our Judeo-Christian civilization. Once they are adjudged to have fully understood all the implications of the traditions, history, and values that make up our Judeo-Christian civilization, which naturally is going to include some religious aspects. But more importantly, if they've got a sense of where they are today and how that came about and the great things about our Judeo-Christian civilization that created the environment in which we all flourish today, if they were given a full appreciation of those history, traditions and values, by all means, then teach them about different religions and cultures, but tell the truth. Tell the truth about the 1400-year history of Islam and the paedophile prophet and the fact that there were 270 million lives that were taken away in the name of Islamic jihad, the tears of jihad over the 1400 years. Tell them that and let them get a full appreciation of what Islam really is rather than what Muslims would like to tell you what it is, which of course is only a whitewashing of the truth.
And we're moving into chapter 16 of the AFDI demands the repeal of the UN resolution 1618 and any other resolutions that might limit the freedom of speech. And Tim and I discussed that one rather handily.
Yeah, we more or less covered
it. It's true. And a lot of people have to realize, Tim, is that when they wrote up Resolution 1618 and they were talking about counterterrorism, they were writing that in the spirit of Sharia. They were not writing it in the spirit of secular law or anything like that. We, in their eye, under this Resolution 1618, the terrorist is the infidel. And a lot of people don't understand that.
I mean, when it was originally drawn up, I'm sure it was done with the best of intentions. They were talking about language and public announcements, whether it's by language or in the written form or however it is, mm-hmm. whatever. They were talking about things that defamed other people's belief systems, and they were talking as if everybody was going to treat these belief systems in equal fashion. But, of course, it was hijacked, twisted, distorted,
so that
the main effect would be no criticism of Islam. And of course, now we realise that we as sensible, rational people talking as we are today can't permit that to be passed and for us to be bound by it. Even if it were passed at the United Nations, we would have to say we do not consider ourselves to be bound by it because it is just too important. If that ever became law and was enforced on us, it would mean the death of a free society and the introduction of totalitarianism, not too dissimilar from what George Orwell envisioned in his book 1984. If you cannot say or write or express your views in any way whatsoever, if it's deemed to offend Islam, then you have no chance. You have to be able to be open and honest about it, to be able to ridicule, mock, and criticize to your heart's content. And if Muslims don't like it, they have just got to suck it up. And that is the way it should be. If their ideology is not strong enough to withstand our criticism, mocking and ridicule, and it crumbles into dust as a result, then so much the better. That is exactly what ridicule, mockery and criticism is for, to explore the weaknesses of various belief systems and let the weakest fall rather than to attempt to hold them up when they're obviously full of holes like the Islamic ideology is. There's no way that Islam would ever survive if the truth were widely known about exactly what is in the Quran and if people were allowed to apostatize. At the moment, the fear of being killed if they apostatize is a very real fear for millions of Muslims. And so
And we all know that 1618 is a closet clause, more or less, to protect Islam. It just angers me that they are saying that there is to be no criticism of religion. However, we all know that as the closet no criticism of Islam. This is a part of their once again the civilization jihad going on here. UN to endorse this. It's very sickening, and that's why I feel that Canada in particular, because we are a Commonwealth country, that we should just stick with the Commonwealth nations and get away from the United Nations, because it's serving no purpose for us in the West.
Well, I certainly think that would be a much more reasonable and common sense approach to take. I mean, we had the Commonwealth in existence for a long time, and I dare say, as with any sort of institution of that magnitude, it wasn't perfect for everybody in any respect, but it's certainly a lot better than what the United Nations is turning into. So if we had to have an international body that we could turn to take the place of the United Nations, it seems to me that that would be something that we could explore, certainly, and that would certainly be far better than the UN at this moment.
We're down to our last 20 minutes in archive time, so we're going to move on to 17. AFDI calls for all Muslim chaplains in prisons and in the military to be thoroughly vetted and dismissed if they have ties to any Islamic supremacist group or if they advocate jihad. Well, you know what? How do we also control that one, Tim? For example, we saw, I mean, the most famous example would be the Fort Hood shootings his name just ran away from me.
Nidal Hassan.
Nidal Hassan. And the warning signs were there, Tim, with this particular person. His business cards had SOA on them, Soldier of Islam, or SOI, rather. Soldier of Islam. I mean, all the warning signs were there. He was prophesizing in his lectures, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I think it was actually SOA, and I think it stood for Soldier of Allah.
Thank you. I did have it right the first time. Okay, Kel, don't think too hard. You roll, Kel.
But the thing about him, I mean, the thing about all these points that we've been going through today is it presupposes that we're able to get rid of the current politically correct and multicultural mindset that has infected our political elites and our mainstream media and criminal justice system for the last 30 or 40 years. Okay, all these points. We'll never get anywhere if we still have political elites and mainstream media that adhere to political correctness and multiculturalism. So let's presuppose that we have the appropriate political circumstances come into place. We replace our governments with people with common sense and some sanity, and we start trying to restore sanity to the way we do things, then these 18 points can come into play. And, of course, you're quite right. If somebody like Nidal Hassan were then in the system, we could point to him and say, you know, this guy describes himself as a soldier of Allah and he's promoting Islamic jihad at every opportunity.
Yeah.
We can then stop him in his tracks, take him out of a position where he can influence or cause damage in a military installation. Obviously, he was able to wreak havoc because nobody had the guts to be able to stand up in this atmosphere of political correctness to what was obviously a problem.
Yeah. In the case of Nidal Hassan, there were people who were actually speaking out, and they were going to their superiors, and they were saying, look, this guy's talking about this in his lectures, and we're a little concerned about it. And they were talked down because, we don't want to offend the Muslim. And that's the thing that we also have to confront, is that we're always concerned about being called racist. And in the chat room tonight, we had Tricia there, and she was saying, look, if they're going to classify me as a racist for criticizing Islam, then fine, I'm a racist. Because title has been diluted to the point where it's meaningless. It's totally meaningless. And the Muslims, they hijacked that label. I mean, a racist is somebody who calls a black a bloody nigger in a corner store or something. That's racism. But to criticize Islam, that is unforgivable for them to take that label and place it upon themselves in that because we criticize Islam that we are the racist. Well, and I know that Islam is not a race, and Islam's not a race. Well, actually, Islam, we have to admit that the majority of Muslims are swarthy skinned. They look like Italians for the most part, and maybe they look like my side of the family, which is Black Irish. So, I mean, who knows? the label of racism, it just bothers me that they throw in our faces.
Well, they only throw it in our faces because it's been effective for them to do that. That's why they've done it. It's the same thing with Islamophobia.
Exactly right. And Islamophobia, that coin was termed via the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928.
As early as that? Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's been around for a very long time.
Oh, all right. I have to say, I thought the term Islamophobia itself wasn't coined until much later. But nevertheless, I haven't got a date in front of me. But the point about Islamophobia is, and the same thing about racism, is that not that they're accurate, because Islam is not a race, and because it's not a phobia when they really are out to kill you. So both of those terms are wrong on their face, but using those terms has been effective for people in order to shut down conversation. And the thing about the liberal left in particular is they probably subconsciously know that their arguments are complete bullshit. And so they can't adequately defend them against people who know what they're talking about, like Robert Spencer, like Pamela Geller, like you and me, okay? If we talk to somebody on the left or liberal side of the political spectrum, you can pretty much say with some degree of certainty that after a short period of time, after they start looking shifty and uncomfortable, they're going to say, oh, you're a racist or you're an Islamophobe, because they can't actually refute the truth of what we say. So the value of those terms for them lies in the fact that they can use them to shut down conversation. Now, if we refuse to accept those terms as being valid and refuse to accept their power for those words to shut them down, then effectively their tool that they've used to shut us down is rendered useless. And most people now are coming round to the idea of thinking that, okay, you can call me a racist if you like, but I know that I'm not one. You can call me an Islamophobe if you like, but I know that I'm not one, and this is why. And they can explain it quite clearly and quite concisely when they've given it a bit of thought, and they can stand up with a clear conscience and say, I don't care what you say when I'm discussing these matters. You can call me a racist or an Islamophobe if you like, but I know that I am not one, because Islam is not a race, because it's not Islamophobia when they really are out to kill you. And you can say, therefore, let's stick to discussing the points in hand, and you cannot refute the truth of those points that I'm putting to you.
And when Hassan al-Banna founded the Muslim Brotherhood, he did coin the term Islamophobia, but it was buried for quite a long time. It didn't really come into popularity until the 1990s, but it a term that he coined when he formed the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928, as it were.
That really is most interesting, because I hadn't realized it had gone back that far. A lot of people don't know that actually racism, the word racism, was coined not too long before that. I thought that the word racism had actually been, until I looked into it, I thought it had been around for, well, I don't know, at least 100 years. But no, it was actually coined not long after the end of the First World War. It's those terms, and racism in particular, people started to think this is a subject for another time, really.
You and myself, I mean, I think we have next Monday's topics already picked out. my goodness, I cannot believe where the time is going. We are in archives, but I'm going to run out of that as well, ladies and gentlemen, and we are going to touch on 6.18, and this one, of course, is very dear to my heart because, you know, living in Canada, I am a staunch supporter of the Keystone Pipeline and energy development, and 18.18, AFDI calls for the development of energy policies that will free us from dependence upon oil from Muslim countries. Tim, take it away.
Well, yes. I mean, we've been talking about the other points, which are basically the things that we can do internally as a society once we have got rid of the concepts of political correctness and multiculturalism that have held us back for the last 30 or 40 years. Those concepts have informed the beliefs of a great many of our political elite and the people who run the mainstream media, and they have really suppressed common sense in many cases, and that's why we have such a problem. But if we get rid of the political correctness and multicultural aspect of things and get a government in with common sense, a lot of these points that we've previously discussed concern things that we can do internally in our society in order to reduce and the effect of Islamic encroachment and to turn back the tide. But this last one deals with another point which is very important because it is a factor in when politicians make their decisions about how they should treat Muslims and all the points that we have discussed, that they have got one thing at the back of the mind, which is, well, if we upset Muslims, we might suddenly find we've got no oil for our economies. And that's not, you know, that's not an impossible thing to happen if Western countries turn around en masse and say we're going to make it very difficult for Muslims to live in Western countries by means of these other points in the 18-point plan. It's not impossible that the Muslim countries could turn around and say, that's fine, we're not going to sell you any oil. Which could be a bit of a problem unless we go in and take it, but that's a discussion for another time. They could be big problem in our economies, and hence developing oil. I mean, we have tons and tons, well, millions of tons of oil underneath. I'm certainly thinking in America and Canada, there are huge, huge oil supplies, gas supplies. Kel's talking about the Keystone pipeline, which runs from where to where, or what is the plan with that?
Well, the idea is that we are developing oil left, right, and center in Alberta, Canada, the province of Alberta, and British Columbia, and we have enough oil to supply the entire North America for like three generations, and Barack Hussein Obama, he's preventing the Keystone Pipeline. It's crude oil that we're developing, and he's preventing a pipeline going into the United States where it can be refined. And that's a big, huge mistake, I think, because we could get off the tip of the Arabian oil yesterday if Barack Hussein Obama would play along. And what Prime Minister Stephen Harper is saying, that, well, if the United States won't take our oil, China certainly will. So thus we might be creating the gateway pipeline now.
Yes, indeed. Well, at the moment, of course, we know why Barack Hussein Obama is so against it, because it would weaken the position of the Islamic world with the United States. If the United States could develop these alternative means of energy and there was less reliance on Middle Eastern oil, of course, the Islamic world would have that much less leverage, and that isn't what Barack Hussein Obama wants. So it doesn't surprise me, because if he's not actually a Muslim, you have to say to yourself, well, if he was a Muslim, what would he be doing different? And the answer is nothing. So even if he's not a Muslim, he's certainly acting in a way that benefits the Islamic world and disadvantages the Western world at every step. Everything he does that. So the fact that he's against the Keystone pipeline doesn't surprise me at all. It saddens me, and I hope very soon, one day, he'll be impeached and out of the way, and there'll be somebody in the White House who purges the administration of all the Muslim sympathizers. But, okay, that's some time in the future. And in the meantime, all we can really do is try and work around that as much as we can. If Canada has got those resources and if Canada can supply China with those resources, then all power to Canada is what I say. But I think it's a great shame
Absolutely.
That a country like the United States is being brought to its knees by the Obama administration. And I really hope one day he is brought to account in the same way that the entire administration is brought to account and strung up from
yeah.
a collective post. But
I'm positive that he...
Today,
yeah, I'm positive that he will be taken to task and he will be brought forward for what he is doing. And but that one point, that final point, people, pay attention to it. Development of energy policies that will free us from dependence upon oil from Muslim countries.
Like the mafia, but we're religious. Hey!